You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest is Leonard Sweet. Leonard is an American theologian, church historian, pastor, and author. Sweet currently serves as the E. Stanley Jones Professor of Evangelism at Drew Theological School at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey, and as a visiting distinguished professor at George Fox Evangelical Seminary in Portland, Oregon. Sweet is an advocate of contextualizing Christianity into a digital culture. He is regularly voted one of the most influential Christian leaders in America. Sweet is ordained in the United Methodist denomination. To start out, I asked Leonard about contextualizing Christianity in a digital culture.
Part of the beauty of Christianity is that it manifests Jesus differently in African culture as opposed to Asian culture, as opposed to Latin American culture, etc. And you got basically, the church is divided into these two camps and about this one issue. There some know you've got to hermetically seal Christian culture and preserve it in this timeless capsule as it moves through history. And that's a fairly popular position. The other one is, no, and of course, this is my position. Jesus said you'd be in the world, not of the world, but not out of it either. So what does it mean to be in the culture, whatever that culture is, but you enter it at a slant, an angle, because you're not to be of it, but you're not out of it either. And of course, the incarnation for me is the great testimony to the fact that whatever Jesus was in a particular culture, spoke a particular language, reflected a particular kind of geographical area, and that's what we are to do as well.
Well, I think the bunch of cliches that we throw around in the church, I mean, just the idea that God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life, and maybe that was very meaningful in the 1960s and modernity, but it lacks any kind of real meaning today. We kind of fail to contextualize it to a digital age.
Right. Yeah. And you know, we're going to be moving quickly. We've had 500 years in a Gutenberg culture, print culture, book culture. We learned how to do book religion, book church. We learned to think book. Our default was book, print. I mean, we're still writing papers. I mean, in a digital culture, you go to college and you're still taught to write papers. Well, where are you doing that in the workplace? You know, you're designing web pages, you're coming up with YouTubes, but our whole educational system is still stuck in a Gutenberg mentality. And we're going to be in digital, I don't know for how long, but it we're going to move out of that into something new very quickly. So the point is, never wedge yourself to any cultural form, but to do it as a missionary would. You go into that culture, you learn, you learn its uniqueness, and you get a feel and a sense of what resonates in that culture, and then the gospel then gets embedded in it, but it doesn't become of it. And but then there's that third one, not out of it either. So that's the triangulation. I call it the cultural triangulation, a good triangulation, in, not of, not out of it.
So let's talk about the new book. It's called The Bad Habits of Jesus, Showing Us the Way to Live Right in a World Gone Wrong. So there's like 15 chapters here, each one about a different bad habit of Jesus. Sometimes Jesus breaks the rules of his own day. Sometimes he breaks them in our present day. He offends our modern sensibilities too. What is so significant about that made you want to write an entire book about it?
Well, it's all for me about how do you lift up Christ in a way in which that's fresh, new, and the people are going to see who Jesus is in a new and exciting way. And so I thought, you know, in a world where, you know, to say something is ridiculous is now to say something good. And, you know, to that's so random is now positive, you know, that I thought we'd play a little bit with these bad habits to get people to relook at Jesus. It's all about lifting up Christ, and if he be lifted up, he will draw. So I'm not a drawing board trying to draw up a new strategy or blueprint. I'm just finding new and fresh ways to lift him up so that he can draw people. And I hope reading this book, people will be drawn closer to in their walk with him and in a relationship with him. So that's what I'm just trying to do, and had a lot of fun doing it, and couldn't believe. I mean, I put this out on, did a little crowdsourcing on the social media, and people came up with hundreds of these. Yeah. I never even thought of some of these bad habits. I'm always immensely struck by the creativity of God's people. If you just let them, if you unleash it and release it, and they came back with hundreds of these. I put some in the book. As you notice, there's some break, and almost every other page there's a breakout with another bad habit that somebody else came up with. So it's an attempt to get people to relook at Jesus in a whole fresh way.
Hey friends, it's me, your host, Shane Blackshear. I wanted to tell you about this week's sponsor. It's InterVarsity Press and their new book, The Road Back to You, written by Ian Morgan Cron and Suzanne Stabile. It's about the Enneagram. If you don't know about the Enneagram, it's an ancient personality typing system that helps people understand who they are and what makes them tick. It's really blown up in the last couple of years, and you probably heard a friend talking about it because it's kind of like CrossFit or being a vegan, because when people get into it, they really get into it, and they talk about it a lot. That's not a bad thing. People really have felt dramatic changes in their life because of the Enneagram. This book will help you know what number you are on the Enneagram and what that means about who God made you to be. Right now, you can get The Road Back to You for 30% off by going to ivpress.com/dropout. The discount is only for a limited time, so don't wait. Go to ivpress.com/dropout and get it today. One of my favorite chapters is the one called Jesus Told Stories That Didn't Make Sense. I think if anybody who's read the words of Jesus and paid enough attention, they've read a parable that left them scratching their head. Was that the normal modus operandi of rabbis? Eastern rabbis, you know, telling mystical stories that made people think, or was there something different about the way that Jesus told stories?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Jesus, there is a whole tradition of parables. I mean, it's not as if Jesus invented the parabolic form. And there is this storytelling tradition that makes you a great communicator. I believe Jesus was the greatest communicator who ever lived. And how did he communicate? And he didn't do the, you know, let me give you these seven habits of highly effective discipleship. He communicated by telling these stories. And part of the reason for that, Shane, is that's why that's such great communication. Is that's how the brain works. Your mind, one of the biggest discoveries of cognitive science, cognitive studies, psychoneurolinguistics. This is kind of the age of brain science right now. And one of the biggest discoveries, your mind is not made of words. Words are the last thing your mind comes up with. Your mind is made of metaphors, which it turns into stories. And you prove that when you dream. You don't dream in words. You'll never ever dream of you reading a book. Your mind doesn't think in words. It thinks in metaphors. So to change people's lives, to change their minds, you got to give them new metaphors, new stories. You have heard it said, and then Jesus says, but I say. So he's reframing, re-signing, if you will, with a whole new set of stories and metaphors. And the difference of Jesus, though, is I think there's a couple, but just the most important is these were stories that really were almost paradoxical, that they had this huge surprise ending. They turned religious observance upside down. I mean, these stories got him killed. So they're just not like any rabbi telling these cute little stories. And these stories caused offense and challenged the system. And, you know, so I don't think it's just like any, it's not just any story. It's, these are like any parable. These were revolutionary parables. I do think we've so far departed from this. I had a Twitter fight. I'm not going to say who it was with, but everybody, all your listeners would know the name. And this person, I don't know if they actually do their own Twitter, but the tweet was, the one unpardonable sin for a preacher is to be unclear. Hmm. And then the next line was, you can be uncertain, but never be unclear. So I just tweeted back, yeah, that's so Jesus. And the Twitter war began. So. And so he had his followers and I had mine. And we just kind of stepped back and let our respective people kind of duke it out. But and it was fun to watch. But after every Jesus quote sermon, the disciples looked at one another and said, well, that's the clearest thing I've ever heard. Now I get that with cut glass clarity. No. I mean, they looked at one another and said, hello.
Yeah.
What was that about? Because Jesus preached for something more than clarity. For him, it was all about conversation, participation, connection, taking it further, stimulating. And then he'd have to come in sometime when the disciples would just take it off in direction and correct them and tell them, no, that's not what I was meaning at all. Let me help you out here. But we have so far departed from this narrative mode of thinking and communicating that we even put stuff in Jesus's mouth and mind that you, anybody reading the Gospels, I mean, these are the, I call them the duh disciples. They're always duh disciples. They never get it. They don't get it. And we still don't get it. And so that's part of the challenge of being a good communicator is giving enough that people it'll stimulate their imagination and their thinking, but not too much that it's okay. That settles it.
To me, that kind of indicates Jesus's, and you kind of alluded to this, Jesus's almost, it seems, preference of relationship over rules. I mean, these are the teachings of Jesus. Like, it seems very important that we follow them. In order to follow them, we have to understand them. But Jesus is telling stories that it seems as if he is begging for his disciples to follow up and say, what does that mean? And it seems like constantly in the scripture, it's like Jesus tells a parable, the disciples, it says the disciples were very confused about this and they were talking about it amongst themselves. And they went to Jesus and said, what did you mean by this? And it seems like Jesus is very purposefully wanting that end when he tells a story.
No, I think you're exactly right. Exactly right. And that's why Jesus loves questions so much. I mean, he's always asking questions. One of my favorite biblical scholars, his name is Conrad Gempe. He teaches at London School of Theology, and he's written this little book, this little gem called Jesus Asked, where he just looks at all the questions of Jesus. I mean, Jesus is, and his basic conclusion is, if Jesus were alive today and you met him on the street, he'd be much more likely to ask you something than to tell you anything. I mean, he's constantly, because questioning is now, this is also part of Hebrew culture. I mean, Jesus was a Jew, and Hebrew culture is all, it's the religious quest is hospitable to questioning, which we've kind of lost. But Jesus takes that and puts it on steroids. He's always asking people. I mean, look at the road to Emmaus. He just sidles into their everyday conversation and asks them a question first. And he's always, you know, he's just always asking these questions, and he leads the discussion through his questions. The other thing I think we miss, Shane, and this is a peripatetic culture. I was just in South Africa, and everybody walks in South Africa. And I was so reminded that we are so used to sitting and driving that, I mean, Roman nobility used to hire people to read while they were walking. They'd have meetings while they were walking. So all of this stuff is while you are walking, you have these incredible conversations. And a lot of Jesus' stories were told while he's walking, either at table or while they were walking. So you got these two extremes, either you're walking or you're at table. Even when you the Shammai and Hillel schools in Jerusalem, the two competing schools where you studied, you didn't sit down for class. You stood, and your rabbi walked around the auditorium, which is where the students were gathered, this one room, this lecture hall. And as he walked, you'd follow him. So it's a very peripatetic, very conversational. And Jesus is just, he's stimulating that conversation so that you can keep walking and talking and taking it further.
One of the ideas that you drive home throughout the book is that we should see and know God for who he is, or Jesus, we should see him and know him for who he is. What does it do for us to see Jesus in this way that you break down as a rule breaker, as somebody with bad habits?
Well, I think it the biggest metaphor for bad for me is the best definition, and this is not my definition. It's somebody I got it from a French theologian, but his phrase in French is translated, the best definition of the gospel is Jesus ate good food with bad people. Hmm. If you can find a better definition of the gospel than that, good luck. But Jesus ate, the whole life of Jesus. Jesus is a foodie. He's always eating. I wrote a book on that called Tablet to Table. But he eats bad good food with bad people. He's constantly surrounding himself with it. Well, who those in the eyes of the world are not the good people. I mean, he's crucified because of the stories he told and at table and the people he ate with at table. The his table mates were scandalous people, and he dies as he lives. I mean, he does. We have this Golgotha one cross. No, and Karl Barth was insistent. You always portray three crosses because the story of Good Friday is not one person dying at Calvary. It's three. Hmm. And there was one good person surrounded by two bad people, but one of the bad people became good. That's the story of Good Friday. Now, as the culture, of course, there's three bad people up there, but we know there's one good, two bad, one of whom became good. And Jesus died as he lived, surrounded by bad people. So this definition of, you know, I'm trying to insidiously, kind of subliminally here, saying, you call yourself the church, show me your bad people. Hmm. You just associating, who are you eating dinner with this week that the world might say is a bad person? If you're just in this little religious bubble of good people, you're just sucking on your own balloon juice, church. That's all you're doing. And that's primarily what a lot of church is doing, because we're not getting out of our bubbles and breathing the air that everybody else is breathing. So I'm trying to call the church to see bad in a whole new way, and to see bad as in some ways, and the culture, you know, that's so bad. Well, that means not good, you know. So we're in a culture where all the words have flipped. So I'm just playing with that a little bit. But these bad habits, I mean, he could be dangerous. He was dangerous. He hung out with these bad people. So these are the bad habits that got him criticized and ultimately killed.
To me, one of the signifiers of Christendom has been an emphasis over perceived purity over mission. So in other words, you know, if we have a problem with people who are addicted to drugs in our town, Christendom says we need to run them out of our town because they're making us unpure. Whereas the gospel says, no, we need to love them and show them the love of Christ so that they will no longer need drugs. That's a little simplistic, but But that emphasis over purity, which Jesus kind of shatters when he sits down to a meal with all the people he sits down with.
Yeah, he really, Shane, flips the holiness code of his day on its head. I mean, in the purity codes, the holiness codes, which is how you were a good Jew, was you kept yourself uncontaminated from all impurities. And that included food. That included people. I mean, hence, if you had any kind of skin, leprosy was more of a just any kind of skin blemish. Even rosacea could, if you had rosacea for the day, I mean, you got to get out your sign and ring your bell because you are now unclean. So the whole holiness code of the religious establishment for Jesus's time was keep yourself pure and unblemished and keep yourself uncontaminated by any kind of sin or shame or filth. And Jesus flips that upside down. He defines holiness not keeping your hands clean, but getting your hands dirty. He didn't just heal lepers. He touched them. So I just say, you know, one of the tests at the pearly gates is going to be show me your hands. You got clean hands, go someplace else. I mean, the heaven's a place for gardener's hands, dirt under the fingernails. You can't wash people's feet without getting your hands dirty and wet. Imagine what it was like if, you know, Mother Teresa just made a saint. I was thinking, wouldn't it be great to be able to hold Mother Teresa's hand? Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. But realize that hand has scooped the feces and vomit off the bodies of dying people. She didn't wear latex gloves. She did it with her hands. She got her hands filthy and dirty. And the whole incarnation is about God getting down and dirty. And if we're not willing to get dirty, I do this in my Jesus Spit chapter, the first one. If you're not willing, and I'm not willing to get down and dirty in mission with others, we're too good for Jesus.
Why do you think we've sanitized Jesus? Is it just that we've lost the cultural context, so we don't know about the purity codes, so it doesn't dawn on us how revolutionary Jesus' actions are, or is there something else at play?
That's a good question. I mean, there's so many possibilities. I think it's and the reason why I've been focusing on Jesus in my recent books is just I think we've lost our first love. We've lost what it means to fall in love with Jesus, and that's what it's all about for Christians. The truth is not a principle or a proposition or a point. The truth is a person who calls us into relationship, and when you lose that under that love for truth, which is a person who calls us into relationship, then you're stuck with the rules and regulations and rituals and all that kind of stuff. So I also, the other thing I think that is doing this to us is, one of the worst days in the life of any parent is when your child comes home and announces they want to play a musical instrument. Because, then you hold your breath and say, well, which one, And my youngest son, he came home and he said clarinet. And I thought, I just took a big sigh of relief. Well, boy, did I luck out. The neighbor kids, both of them did the drums. And my kid wants to do a clarinet. But I'll tell you, my sigh of relief turned into a sigh of agony. Because what this kid did to some of the most beautiful music in the history of musicology was an absolute embarrassment. I mean, the notes that he that came out of his bedroom as he's trying to play Brahms, and I mean, he massacred this. I mean, he massacred these greatest composers. And of course, my response to him is, I go into his bedroom and I'd say, that sounds so much better than yesterday. With my tongue between my teeth, because I wanted to learn to play his instrument. So I encourage him, because his instrument takes practice to learn. And the bottom line here, faith is an instrument that takes practice to learn. You got to learn to practice your faith. And what happens is our churches cannot handle. They are not communities of practice. They're communities of perfection. Somebody comes to say, I'm now a follower of Jesus. Oh, great. Now we expect from you perfection. No, they've got to learn to practice their instrument. And so when they massacre passages of scripture in their lives, we immediately, you know, get thee out of here. You're condemned, when we should be encouraging them to keep practicing, mm-hmm. to get it better mm-hmm. next time. And so this whole focus on a church that doesn't see faith as a practice that you get better at over time, and that we encourage one another and we love one another into better playings of our instrument. We are this judge, which, judge and jury are condemning people because they haven't gotten it right when they're just starting the journey. So yeah, I just think it's horrible. We wouldn't do that with our kids, but we do it with our kids in faith in the church all the time.
So I want to end asking about a different book, Soul Tsunami. That was huge for a lot of people. I told you before we started recording, when I was in college, a college minister of mine introduced me to your books, and Soul Tsunami was the first. It's been almost 20 years since that was published. Is that right?
Yeah.
For those who don't know, do you mind just giving a real brief explanation about what Soul Tsunami was about?
Yeah, it was a wake-up call to the church that there was a tsunami about to hit the church. And coming from this digital electronic culture, that basically digital culture would have the impact that the Gutenberg press had on the church, the medieval church, this digital culture would have on the modern church, or the print church, the book church. And I predicted I had 10 waves that were coming, and I predicted the nature of those waves and what to do about it. Unfortunately, a lot of people read the book. Shane, as you know, it was a bestseller.
Yep.
But nobody listened to me. And my generation, the boomer generation, every single one of those, what I called life rings, they went another direction. I mean, if you look at what the church has been debating about, it's all in that one book. I mean, I nailed the problem, but people have been debating about those problems in that book ever since. But every single life ring, they threw out another one. And, my generation did this. It's my generation that did this. And I'm trying to find one thing the boomer generation led the church right in, because every single move that we made, every single decision that we made, and choice for the church moving into this future, we chose wrong. And Doug Mirren and I are working on a book now that just kind of, but I can't publish the book until I find something right that we did.
Oh, wow.
As a generation. But yeah, it's kind of the sadness of my life that I wrote this book and everybody read it and nobody listened to it. Everybody just went off in their own direction and said, thank you for that book. That tells us what's coming. And then people who read it now go, wow, did you nail that?
Yeah.
But every single thing that I suggested we do to get through this, people have decided to take a different course. They've listened to different drummers, and the church has a right to do that, but now we're suffering from it. So it's kind of a sad book for me. It's a bellwether book, but a book that also tried to say, this is how you chart your course through these very dangerous waters. So it's kind of a lamenting book for me. I'm glad it sold so well, but I just wish that people had taken it seriously.
But I'm sure on a micro level that really was a game changer for a lot of people and a lot of churches and in their context. And maybe we didn't see a wave, to use your terminology, we didn't see a wave of change throughout the church in the world, but I know that for a lot of people that was a huge game changer for them. I'm wondering.
Well, it's kind of you to say that, Shane. Thank you.
Well, I remember the stuff I read, and then as it came to fruition, just kind of thinking like, yeah, I knew that was going to happen. The book was really prophetic, and even people could still read it today and get a world of good out of it. I'm curious now, 20 years later, if you have anything that you would add or change about the book looking back.
Well, yeah, I have offered publishers to do a new Soul Tsunami book, Soul Tsunami 2.0, if you will. Let's look at the next 20, 30 years and see what's coming. By and large, the publishing world, I mean, I can write it and self-publish it, but they don't seem to be really interested in that kind of question.
That's shocking.
Yeah, it also says something about the state of the church. It's so hunkered down. It's afraid to face, you know, we're all in these little holy huddles, just hunkered in and hunkering on our bunkers and afraid to look at what's coming on the horizon. And the publishing world not wanting to take the risk to do something about it. I thought of, you know, a nice 20 anniversary. This was Soul Tsunami 1. Let's do
Tsunami
2 or something, but nobody seems interested. So
I'm really shocked that that's that hard of a sell for publishers. Well, if you self-publish, I'll read it. How about that?
Okay. You and me, Shay. Okay. Maybe I ought to do a private circulation book, you know.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, just email me a PDF. It'll be fine.
Okay, there you go.
Well, Leonard, it's been so good talking with you. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Shay, it's been great talking. Love Austin, Texas.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,